For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Good morning, everybody. Many of you are here as part of the half-day sitting, and I hope that is going well for you, and welcome to the people who are joining us for just the Zazen period and the Dharma talk as well. I'm glad to have you join us, and I'm really happy to be here. And as I think about my talk, I have to confess that for the Kinhin period, at least before the talk, I sit and I sort of, you know, think about like, how am I going to remember to say all the things I want to say? And I think I have to just let that go. I want to try to make sure to say everything that I wanted to say, but it's not always possible. And really, what I'm about to talk about is a story of letting go. So I'm going to let that serve as sort of a reminder for me. I want to talk with you today about one of our women ancestors, Mugai Nyodai, who, although she lived from 1223 to 1298 in Japan, she would have been a contemporary of Dogen. She would have been studying within the Rinzai tradition. And so she's not in our Soto lineage, but we still chant her name as one of the women ancestors when we chant, you know, the Buddhas and ancestors and the women ancestors during a longer session. And there are some conflicting details to her story. There's actually, there's a lot we don't know about many of our women ancestors, sometimes beyond, you know, a name or and dates, and some particular thing that's attributed to them. That's actually true for a number of our male ancestors as well, because, you know, records are lost and scholarship is incomplete. But the story of Mugai Nyodai actually appears in a number of places. It appears in the Hidden Lamp Collection that came out recently. It appears in a book called Women of the Way that came out about 10 years ago. And in a few other sources that you can find online. It also, a brief excerpt appears in the book Zen Flesh, Zen Bones, which is one of the first books I ever read on Zen. It was one of the two books that was assigned in my college class on Buddhism. And this account, I think, contains sort of the essential elements. So I will start with this. And this, the title is No Water, No Moon, and it's number 29 in Zen Flesh, Zen Bones. And I should tell you that Mugai Nyodai's given name from childhood was Chiyono. And so this is a story about Chiyono, and it's about Chiyono's awakening and the poem that she wrote after this. So it goes like this. When the nun Chiyono studied Zen under Bukko of Engaku, she was unable to attain the fruits of meditation for a long time. At last, one moonlit night, she was carrying water in an old pail bound with bamboo. The bamboo broke and the bottom fell out of the pail, and at that moment, Chiyono was set free. In commemoration, she wrote a poem. In this way and that, I tried to save the old pail, since the bamboo strip was weakening and about to break, until at last the bottom fell out. No more water in the pail, no more moon in the water. So I'll read it again. In this way and that, I tried to save the old pail, since the bamboo strip was weakening and about to break, until at last the bottom fell out. No more water in the pail, no more moon in the water. So, stories like this one, this recounting in particular, contain really only the barest facts. And I think if we are, you know, if we've spent any time in Zen contexts at all, we can sort of think through, you know, intellectually, like, oh, okay, so, you know, we need to let things go, not be always putting ourselves together, not be always, you know, trying to hold on to things. Just let go, and let go of your delusions is one of the accounts that we get about Chiyono. And that's not wrong, but I think it's to really understand this story and this poem and what it's talking about, I think we have to know and understand more about the life of this individual and the context that that life took place in. And really, that's what helps us use these as a guide to sorting through our own life and maybe our own you know, deeply held beliefs and delusions. So I'll tell you a little bit about what I know of the story of Mugai Nyodai. And as I said, there are conflicting accounts, but probably, given what we know of the time frame of her life, she would have been a well-to-do older woman when she started to practice. There are other accounts of Mugai Nyodai or Chiyono as a poor servant girl, and I think that that's not really true. She would have started practicing maybe when she was around 60. And as I mentioned, her given name was Chiyono. She lived in Kamakura and likely came to practice sometime after her husband died, which would have been for her around, we think, around age 54. So sometime after her husband died and her mother died and her only daughter had married and moved away, and something in Chiyono called her to practice at this time in her life. And we know that she began to study with Wu Shu Tsuyuan, who was Chinese, but had established a temple in Kamakura, Engakuji. And his Japanese name, Buddhist name, would have been Mugaku Sogen, or I think in Zen Flesh, Zen Bones, they call him Bukko, or refer to him as Bukko, and he would have been a Rinzai teacher. So we know that the temple was built in 1282, and that Mugaku Sogen died in 1286. So sometime within that period, Chiyono went to practice and had the experience that I just read to you. Both stories about Chiyono suggested that she practiced for a long time without understanding, without really, you know, feeling like she had some peace or got it. But one day, or one night, maybe, as she was fetching water, which may have been her Dharma job, you know, everyone has a job. One night as she was fetching the water, the bucket broke and the water ran out of the pail. And, you know, this probably had happened before. You know, it was an old bucket. She says in the poem, you know, that she tried to patch the bucket back together again and again. And something about this particular occasion, for whatever reason, she just was ripe to have some other experience and maybe recognized the aptness of this metaphor to her own life and wrote this poem about, you know, I tried and tried to patch things together, but it broke anyway, and so now what? So she was awakened somehow with this. And so I think that we can, you know, entertain a lot of different questions about this experience, you know, maybe that within our own life. And one of the first questions that comes up for me is, you know, how can this story impact our practice? I think I think I just said that, you know, maybe she had patched that bucket together a lot of times, and this time she sort of awakened when it broke. So, you know, we know from Dogen that practice is not linear. We're not practicing now for the purpose of, you know, getting something else later, and we're not, you know, getting a little bit now, and maybe later on we'll get a little bit more. And yet, you know, realization happens to some extent on its own timetable. We don't really expect to understand the world the same way at 60 as we did when we were 20. Or if we do, we can look back and realize, oh, you know, right now I understand the world so differently from when I was 10. You know, so something happens. You know, our experiences shape us, and you know, how are we maybe repatching an old bucket in our own lives is a thought that comes to me. You know, how many times must Chiono have patched that bucket, and is patching the bucket or repatching it wrong? You know, we have to find a way to deal with sort of the practical things in our lives, and is it diluted? Is it, you know, is patching wrong and letting go right? I think that's a question that we all have to entertain. Maybe sometimes patching is the right thing to do, and sometimes letting go is the right thing to do, and sometimes we don't have a lot of control over it because we don't even realize that we're patching, you know? So for ourselves, you know, maybe is holding on to our beliefs or delusions or self-identifications wrong? You know, when do we need to hold on to these, and when can we let go a little bit? And is letting go permanent? Given that I've just been suggesting that, you know, we change throughout our lives and we may experience things differently, you know, maybe we can let go for a time, and then in letting go, we let go of letting go and realize we need to, you know, hold on to something. So one of the things that we know about Chiono is that she came to practice at a point in her life when she was no longer a daughter or a mother or a wife, and was probably grieving these losses as one, you know, might in that situation. You know, maybe not just grieving the people, but also grieving that relationship or that role in her life. And, you know, maybe entertaining a question of, you know, who am I? Who am I when these significant aspects of my life are no longer? You know, what is left? I think that we can all relate to this in some way. Maybe I'll come back to that. I guess I'll just even on a relatively superficial level. 2 weeks ago, we held a camping sesshin where we camped out for 3 days of a sesshin, and we followed a sesshin schedule. And those of us who were there put together a zendo, which was a 10-foot by 20-foot canopy, and it had, you know, a lovely roof and sides, and the sides that weren't, you know, plastic, we put screen up, and so we had this wonderful zendo, which is the same zendo that we had put up the year before, and it worked great, and it worked great this year for about, you know, 12 hours, and then was picked up by the 20-mile-an-hour winds that we had this year that we didn't have last year, and was carried into a tree. We came back from our nature walk and found our zendo wrapped around a tree with some of the poles hopelessly broken, and we kind of just stood there for a moment and said, well, you know, what do you think about that? And it was kind of funny because our whole zendo setup was perfectly preserved over here, and this mangled zendo is like over here, and it wasn't going to be usable for this retreat. I did not want it to fall, even if we tried to patch it together. I didn't want it falling on people while we were sitting, and so you know, it took us some trial and some thinking and some reflection, and at first we just sat in our zendo setup the way it was, sans tent. And then it occurred to a few of us that maybe the thing to do would be to take the poles that formed the perimeter of the roof and detach them from the rest of the mangled thing and just put the poles around our cushions, sort of where it had been, so that we at least had, you know, the demarcation of a zendo, so that we could feel, you know, at least that little bit of containment. And that turned out to be enough. You know, just a little bit of support was fine. And you know, maybe I think the most important thing was that we all still had a zendo in our minds. We had internalized a feeling of, like, you know, here's where we bow and here's where we actually would go into our zendo that is no longer here. And so you know, I think it kind of brought to mind the question of, you know, what remains when we lose our customary forms or our customary conventions? You know, how can we respond appropriately, or how can we continue to respond appropriately, and what is left of us? So, so we have these questions. One of the other aspects of this story that appears in the other two accounts that I mentioned, it's not so prominent in the account that I read to you, but you know, they talk about how, you know, after this experience, Chiyono released her delusions and was awakened, and or resolved her delusions. And so it brings up the question of, you know, what are delusions? I mean, what I think we maybe have a mental image in some way in our minds when we read that or hear it of, like, oh, okay, you know, that's what we do. But, you know, delusions is not such a great word, because it's kind of a word that's tinged already with a judgment. And so maybe a more neutral word would be beliefs or identifications or, I don't know, those are two good ones. One thing I know about that, though, is that we can't resolve or release them in the abstract. You know, the account of Chiyono is the account of someone looking at her from the outside and saying, here's what she did. But actually, in our own selves, in our lives, we don't have somebody out there saying, oh yeah, here's what you're doing right now, you're resolving your delusions. We have to sort of, you know, feel our way through our experience, and observe, you know, maybe the particular stories that we tell ourselves about what the world is and who we are and what our place is in the world. And these stories, as we will chant later, are, you know, inexhaustible. We will always have some. They are part of, you know, we need them to survive. They kind of give us some sort of sense of context of our lives. We do, to some extent, need to patch our bucket and maintain a sense of who we are in order to, you know, get things done in the world, in order to feed ourselves or you know, survive. And so there's the question of, you know, when can we let them go? But there's also the question of how can we let them go? And there's, I think there's lots of ways to let these things go. We'll be chanting the Song of the Grass Hut later, in which one of the lines is, let go of hundreds of years and relax completely. You know, how can we let go of all of our conditioning? You know, we kind of are who we've been conditioned to be. We think the world is what we've been, you know, taught by others or by experience that it is. But how can we let go of the hundreds of years of that? Now, there's also a line that says, bind grasses to build a hut and don't give up. So we have that tension in our lives. And as I was thinking about this, I was thinking about, one way to let go of our beliefs is to have our situation change such that we don't need them anymore, or that we can sort of forget about them. And I was thinking about one of my two cats who is very, very, very shy. And we've had her for about 5.5 years. And for about the first 6 months of her living with us, we couldn't find her. And we could see that she, every once in a while, we could see like a little black shadow dart across the room, and, you know, she'd get some food, and I think she mostly came out at night. And it took us a little while, but we figured out that she was actually living in the lining under our couch. So she's not even touching the ground. We could just see sort of this weird sag under our couch, and there she is, you know, just probably, you know, trembling and vibrating in there. And I thought about, you know, that seems like a horrible existence. You know, how do you help someone not be afraid? And the best I could come up with is to have things be, you know, quiet enough and peaceful enough and predictable enough that that maybe she would, you know, kind of forget that she was afraid of us. And I think, you know, she has to participate. She has to want to, you know, do something outside of that little cocoon. But I think that's true for all of us. You know, we have to want something outside of our own little, you know, cocooned existence. And we have to be willing to take a risk to see if, you know, maybe things aren't so bad out there. And, you know, maybe for us consciously, I'm not sure that my cat was doing this, we have to weigh for ourselves, you know, is it worth it? Do I want to do this? Is this a delusion, or is this something that is actually keeping me safe? You know, what are the benefits of going out there versus the risks? And I think about, some of you have maybe read the book Being Upright by Tenshin Reb Anderson, and he, in one of the later chapters, talks about the gift of fearlessness, which is, I think, as a sangha, you know, something that we all can offer each other. It's really finding ways to help someone feel, you know, respected and encouraged to just be themselves. You know, just the idea of the gift of fearlessness is it helps beings to feel okay about being themselves, that we can offer each other our listening, our respect, our regard, that we are, you know, good enough as we are, even though we may sometimes have to offer each other a little bit of guidance or correction. Or a reminder. And so one way of kind of working with our beliefs or delusions is by ourselves, and another way is to do it together. We don't know what beliefs some about themselves or the world someone else is holding on to. But we can offer, you know, a reflection of someone as okay, you know, okay, and maybe they will decide, you know, what they need to hold on to and what they can let go of, and maybe we can do that for ourselves as well. You know, we can't approach these aspects of our life with the idea of getting rid of them, but just as a way of, you know, sitting with them and, you know, sitting with and practicing and reflecting on, okay, do I have to be this way? How did I come to be this way? Maybe I can let that go, or maybe I can do something different with it. There's more beyond our, you know, our need to defend ourselves or define ourselves than we even know. You know, I think as Chiono's example, I think it can be instructive for me. You know, when I imagine that her relationships as a wife and a mother and a daughter really defined for her. You know, this is who you are. This is your context. And when that breaks away, you know, who knows what's out there? I don't know that any of us do. So letting go of that need to defend or define can be scary, but holding on to them can be very limiting. I mean, do you really want to live under someone's couch for the rest of your life? I sometimes do, you know, and sometimes I don't. And I often do, actually. But then there are those moments of like, no, let's see what else is out there. So back to Mugai Nyodai. She was awakened and was ultimately became the first Japanese woman to receive Dharma transmission and founded the first Buddhist convent in Japan. Keiji was the first, I believe, the first woman Rinzai teacher. And that's part of why she's revered on our, you know, women ancestors list. But I think the story of, you know, how that came to be is maybe even more important and can really be an inspiration for our practice. And I think maybe one of the last things I want to mention, I forgot to mention this part, is that, you know, another way of letting go of our beliefs or delusions is to listen to and read and learn more about some of these old stories or chants or sutras so that we're familiar enough with them that they are, you know, kind of just rolling around in the back of your head. And, you know, maybe something happens in your life that is, you know, like you're in the middle of it and you're like, oh, yeah, right, that's kind of just like Chiono's bucket. And that helps us to get a little bit of a, you know, the background music in our life in a way that, you know, oh, okay, this is what's happening now, or this is one of the things that's happening now. So, you know, when we have the opportunity to chant the women ancestors, you'll hear Mugai Nyodai, and hopefully that will, you know, remind you of this story and ways that maybe that applies in your life. And I think maybe that's our time situation. I think that's maybe all I want to say, but maybe we can have a little bit of a discussion about this. Whether people have questions or comments or reflections on this story or really anything else as part of our half-day sitting, please feel free.
Roles and identities dropping away and then trying to piece together an identity and discovering that that whole enterprise, the bottom falls out. What I'm left with is that last bit. Where, in the Buddhist or Zen tradition, what does the moon and the water often represent, and what does it mean that it's not there at that point?
Yeah, I know. I thought about that too. What I have my own thoughts on it, but do you have any thoughts?
I often, you know, sort of the interplay of beings and objects and self and the world around us is reflected in one another. But I don't. There seems to be something more specific about the moon and the water that I wonder.
Yeah. Maybe, Howard, you want to comment?
I was wondering about that, too, because, I mean, that image comes up so often. It's a favorite image of the reflection of the moon and the water. And so you have the bottom falling out, and it might have fallen out multiple times that you keep having to rematch it. And I don't know, for me personally, I'm kind of like, it's almost the story for myself of don't get too attached to text and metaphor or image.
Anybody else want to offer? Nozan?
No, I've got something else. So you should, or somebody else should respond.
Oh, okay. Well, all right. I don't have the answer either, but I did think about this, and I almost talked about it, and then I thought it was, this is going to lead us in a whole different direction. Although I'm glad you led us in that direction. I just didn't want to do it. You know, you're right that the moon in the water is often sort of an image for the Dharma, and that it's reflected in any, you know, any, even a raindrop or a puddle or a lake or, you know. But it's, I don't know, two things come to mind. One is, you know, the holding on to it. And I think that the minute we try to hold on to it, we've really lost it. You know, even just to portray it in literary form is to stain it with defilement. Just to say this is it is too much. It's right there before we say anything. And if our bucket breaks and we no longer, you know, hold on to it, well, where is it? You know, I think that's a question that we all maybe have to answer, but maybe Tom has the answer.
If we're the moon's in the sky, we're no longer looking at the reflection of the moon. The reflection is gone.
So we're
one with the moon in the sky.
Okay, I was thinking maybe because of the light that is, you know, kind of getting an evenly cast glow over everything. So maybe it's everywhere and it's part of us.
Yeah. Something that occurred to me was that it's something about concept, like the moon is not in the bucket, so it's like in that instance, like, you know, what is, you know, like just concepts.
Yeah. What's in the bucket after that? Emptiness. Right.
and so,
the whole thing.
And then just having studied a little Rinzai and tried to work on blue, I think it's kind of like that instantaneous, like maybe she just got it, like it's all her, it's all concepts.
Yeah, that's good, right, that you said that, because one account that I was reading talks about that. That was how she got part of her name, was Mugai, the Mu of emptiness.
Yeah. This is a slightly different direction, but I do like your response. I thought it was a lovely talk.
Thanks.
You know, and this is less to do with the story about her, the story of her camping session. But at first, I was really reminded of this story in the Blue Cliff with the book of Serenity, where the Buddha is walking with his companions, and he says, "This place would be good to build a sanctuary." And Indra takes a blade of grass and plants it in the ground and says, "The sanctuary is built." I'm thinking of your poles, and the poles marking out. And that's what sort of leads me to this question of, do you think, could you say anything about ways in which we might use illusions of the sort, I mean, or limitations, or however you want to put that, in kind of an awakened way? I mean, you set up these poles, and you kind of had a zendo, but it was kind of it worked, right? But it was like not,
I know, well, I don't know that I can answer that in the abstract, to tell you the truth. I think that, you know, we all have this ability to be responsive and creative and meet the situation at hand, but I don't know that anybody would have thought of doing that were we not confronted with the situation. So, you know, I think we all have to meet whatever that situation is in our lives where, you know, the agenda gets thrown out the window and you're just kind of stuck with this broken situation.
It makes me talk enough about how we use our imaginations to heal ourselves. So we use the holes in imagination. But, you know, for example, if you don't have enough love, you can imagine over time. If we were, I suppose, so I'm thinking of it for oneself, but also for the rest of the world. You know, we work with our imaginations to change how we feel about ourselves, about the world, about all sorts of things. Imagination is very powerful. And so the same way, that's what makes me think of.
Sure.
The poles were enough, and then imagination did the rest of it.
Sure. And another way along with that maybe is to observe, you know, to use your example, if we, you know, have a feeling of we don't have enough love, maybe it's possible to observe all the love that is, whatever love is around us and whatever love is within us, and to find that somewhere. I was thinking about... My first thought is not always the most complete thought, but one of the things that we discovered with the Zendo situation is that, it's broken, but it's fine. You know, it's perfectly fine. And so that's another thing that maybe we can do is to the extent that something in our life feels broken, how can we find, you know, the parts of it that are fine? How can we see it as just, you know, this is what it is? We can feel deprived about our circumstances. Or we can feel, you know, maybe a different way about our circumstances. There are situations where we truly do not have enough of something, and I don't mean to make light of that, but there are lots of situations where we feel like we kind of could do a lot better if we had a little bit more of this. But that's, I think, an opportunity too, you know, to see like, okay, how is your life okay? You know, maybe you're not going to be a star gymnast, you know, or whatever it is. But so is that the only thing to be in life, and we're going to get hung up on that, or can we find a way to respond to whatever it is that we have, or that we are?
Thank you for your talk. Yeah, I think this conversation about like between identity and letting go is a really important one, especially. Buddhism in a modern Western context in America, I guess it's a global context, because, you know, because class and gender and race and state power, these are not delusions, these are not things you can like, these are real things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm influenced by the way of tenderness, which we read by Zendo Rinpoche. It's really direct to this point about like what identities are real and which ones are, and like how do you navigate that in life and balance that with practice and this letting go. I'm a big fan of both and. I love making ourselves more multidimensional and more complex and keep kind of exploring and playing with that for our whole lives. I mean, a lot of times race, class, gender, and state power are not playful things, but they are, you know, they're real. Gender can be fun, but a lot of times it's not a letting go process. It's sort of just the context you're in. But at the same time, you know, there is a letting go that of like, I don't know, I just, for myself, like I can feel an essence that doesn't have any of those qualifications on it,
mm-hmm.
that is
mm-hmm.
real
mm-hmm.
as well, you know, that is not attached. So, you know, I think it's an important conversation to bring up, and it's one that, especially for ourselves right now, as where there's a lot of white folks in the Sangha, it's one that we should, where the amount of privilege that we talk about, if our identity is real or not, we should be mindful of that. Because I think it's a very different, if this was a majority of people of color Sangha, I think it would be a very different kind of conversation.
Thank you so much for that and for the reminder of that. That's actually part of why I started studying the women ancestors was for a long time I felt like, well, just what you said it so nicely, like this essence that isn't really anything that, and I was sort of like, well, that's, Buddha nature, a lot of stories actually about the women ancestors are about how Buddha nature does not take, the form of a man or a woman or any particular thing. It's everywhere, but we do have to encounter it in the particulars of that we're born into, whatever aspects of our life are here and present, and even if they are social constructs, as I think Zenju talks about, that we have to live them, and so. Yeah, some of them, like wife, daughter, mother, may come and go, but there are pieces that are permanent. And that, I think, was what made me start realizing that maybe it is actually important to really pay attention to, the women ancestors and what they have to teach me about life. Or even what, that identification has to offer. In terms of the Dharma, and so we each experience the Dharma it doesn't exist if it doesn't exist in the context of each of our own lives. It's just, something out there that doesn't, it can't help anybody or be anything, because it's not really anything except that it manifests in all of the particulars of our lives. So I really appreciate you bringing that up. Other reflections? Kathy.
Thank you very much for that talk. I related to the bottom point on the black blanket, because it made me think about it, and I like the idea of using the Sangha as a tool to identify with the Sangha.
Yeah, yeah. You can't really predict what they're going to be either. So, right, maybe reflect on someone else's experience or imagine another option. Imagine something that's more adaptive. Pattern is a really great word that hadn't occurred to me, but that's another great, kind of plug and play aspect of our existence.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think we're the same way. And, you know, we really get stuck in that.
I want to know how you can predict how far we'll go outside our nest. Now I'm going to have to look into that. that's a whole interesting concept right there. So any last? Thanks so much. These have all been really illuminating and helpful comments and observations, and you've all sort of contributed to my sort of thinking about and understanding this text and lots of other things.